Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Jerry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm KDO.
We own several restaurants around here, don't we, Chef?
That's right. Pretty decent one, too, I think. I mean, from day to day. You know, I have two of them, and I don't hear too much complaint. Luke in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle.
And I have a bunch more just up the road here in Midtown, the Dahlia Lounge, Etta's down in the Market, and Carlisle Room. That's about the stretch of my joints, right? Carlisle up by the Paramount Theater to the Etta's in the Pike Place Market. That's about as far as I can walk.
I'm really spanning the city, though.
Spanning the globe.
That's what about
one street at a time?
South Lake Union.
Of course we have
that,
too.
That's another stretch.
We have a big show for you today. There's many things going on. We're thankful that you've tuned in, no matter where you are or what you're thinking. We're here for 2 hours every Saturday and Sunday, and we're going to learn how to taste, literally the science of taste, with chef and author Becky Selengut. We're going to share our favorite taste of the week, which is always fun to think back of all the goodness that you've had over the week. And sometimes it can just be so simple, but mine had something to do. My wife put on, along with a few other farmers, and a seed person out of Oregon State University, they put on the Sagra de Radicchio.
Love those posters.
Yeah, they were beautiful, weren't they?
Yeah.
It was a whole festival just on chicories for the weekend, and I believe maybe 10 chefs had brought different things that they cooked with different chicories to the ballroom, so they did that. They did chicory festival pizza at the London Plain down there in Pioneer Square. They had a big party the night before. It was all things bitter.
Bitter and delicious and
Yeah, and the oh God, why can't I think of the name of the farmers, Local Roots, who specialize in chicories, came with all of their different product, the Belgian endive and escarole and all the different things that comprise chicory. And they set up a farm stand with all these so you can kind of touch and smell and taste them raw.
Radicchio, Trevis, and so, all my stuff.
But here I am talking about it, and that was going to be my taste. I'll tell you my favorite actual chicory meal that I had.
Okay, there we go.
During our taste segment.
Let's tease it out.
We're going to drink some Beaujolais with Jack Cowan of the French-American Chamber of Commerce.
November 16, once again, the Beaujolais Nouveau is coming.
Yeah. It's such a big deal worldwide.
It is crazy. It's a beautiful marketing.
It's not even wine yet, really, is it? It's more like grape juice.
Yeah, it's grape juice on steroids. It's almost a wine, but not quite a wine yet. Uh-huh. So it's perfect for everybody from age, 10 to 100.
Yeah.
It's an adolescent wine.
Correct.
Yeah, it still is alcoholic, though, so you can't just do that, Terry. You're going to get people in trouble.
Sorry.
And, of course, we're going to go toe-to-toe on food trivia at the end of the show. Brittany Bartolame is going to be here from the Dahlia Bakery.
Dory Greenspan.
Dory Greenspan's going to be here. It's a big, big show. You don't want to miss a minute of it. But first, we're going to jump into Ordinary to Extraordinary.
That's right. This is where you take ordinary dishes and make them extraordinary. I think probably people are pretty excited about getting a pot of chicken soup on the stove right now.
Yeah.
But how do you make it extraordinary?
How would I do it?
Yes.
I got to say, I am so into dumplings. I would take chicken thighs with the skin. Mm-hmm. I put them in my food processor, all boned out.
Yep.
And then I would take a big chunk of ginger, maybe a clove or two of garlic. I don't want to overwhelm with garlic because we don't cook this a lot. You're really going to taste the flavors. Some fresh cilantro, some cute little Thai chili or something like that with some heat to it. And then I would just puree the whole thing up. So the fat, the skin is there for the fat. You want a little fat. And then you got the meat and then all the seasonings. Probably a little dash of fish sauce. I can't say it.
Fish sauce.
Or soy sauce, either one. And then I've just whirl it up in my food processor and make the dumpling mix, get some wrappers from Chuchong Noodle Company in Chinatown. You can find them in any grocery store and make myself a little wonton chicken soup, wonton soup.
Mm. That sounds delightful.
And what I love about soups like that, Terry, and you know this about me, is I like to build the soup, all the ingredients, like more thinly sliced yellow onion, a little bit of cilantro leaf, a little bit of Thai basil, a little bit of maybe Chinatown barbecue pork, and I like to put that in the bowl.
Right.
Then I just put my hot dumplings on top of that and then my broth on top of that. Mm-hmm. So you don't cook those other things.
You just warm them up.
You just kind of warm them up and let the fragrance come out of them.
Can I ask you a question about your wonton soup in this scenario, mm-hmm. Tom? Which is that, you know, we are so accustomed right now with bone broths and things that are like these, you know, long simmered stocks. Mm-hmm. But when I go to Chinatown, I'm having a wonton soup. It's generally a fairly light.
It's almost
broth.
Always
it's
water.
Almost like water.
It's like
just
water,
like
and sometimes a little bit of that extract of stock or whatever. What do you want to call that?
It's almost always water, and typically it might have some cabbage cooked in it or something. But it's they'll
very
cook
light.
The wontons in that water, and then sometimes they use that water. You know,
but that's really it. Is that where you're getting all that flavor from?
I use chicken. I make a chicken broth.
Okay.
You know, so I like having a little broth personally. But in Chinatown, it's very typical to use water. Even if you're making like spare ribs with garlic sauce, right?
Mm-hmm.
You fry the spare ribs. You put them in the wok with fresh garlic. And because the spare ribs have a cornstarch breading on them, you hit that with water. They don't use stock in their sautés like that. You hit that with water, and then you cook it with the spare ribs and the water.
It makes its own slurry.
It does. It makes its own sauce.
And,
I think for
very
me.
Very typical.
Yeah, for me, it would be all about caramelizing and all those vegetables, the onion, the carrot, the celery. All those vegetables really give it a nice color in the bottom of the pan before I put my whole chicken in there and some chicken stock or water if you don't have any chicken stock, because it's going to become chicken stock anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit of sea salt, and then put that on the fire and cook it very slowly. As soon as it comes to a boil, put all your aromats in there. I would put a little bit of ginger, just because I like that in my soup now. Didn't grow up that way, but definitely like it now. A couple of clove of garlic, bay leaf, fresh thyme, and then cook that very slowly for a couple of hours. And then take the chicken out, break it down, so you can put it back into your bowl, into your soup. And then take all the vegetables out and serve them on the side, a little sea salt, some cornichon pickles. And then put all the broth right on top of the chicken.
Tom is making a very crazy face.
Well, I thought you were going down the stock road, but you've cooked it a couple of hours. Your vegetables are not going to have any texture.
Oh, they're going to be soft for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're soft. Yeah. By the time I'm done with my chicken.
So that's your style.
That's
chicken.
My style of.
Yeah.
That's just my style of.
All right.
I grew up in a household where by the time you were done with the boiling of the vegetable,
they were
boiled.
Yeah.
They were like cooked.
Exactly.
I like this. We got two very different takes on chicken soup today.
Right. And I also like to make more than I need so I can freeze one and then take it out, you know, the next week and then have another batch of it.
All right. Up next, we're going to talk smoking fish with Mike Mondello of Made in Washington, that shop down there in the Pike Place Market. Now I see them at the airport. I imagine they're all over the place. Just don't know how far they go. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back in the kitchen, the Seattle kitchen, on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. It's Chef Tom Douglas.
And Jerry Rogero, the chef in a hat.
Hey,
we have Mike Mondello here. He's the CEO of Made in Washington. You've seen the shops all over the place. I remember the very first one in the Pike Place Market when I was chef and general manager of Cafe Sport way back when. Mike, you and I have a lot more gray hair than we did then.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
And now I see the shop. I'm always checking on our product placement at the airport and always kind of checking in on all the things that are Seattle. I love that part about it. It's really a nice wave to the locals. That produce so much good stuff here in Seattle, whether it's food or books or glass even, right?
So. That's right. That's what makes the fun shopping, and also it's fun for us. We love meeting all the local artisans and food makers around the state. It's really cool.
Right. And, you know, it's also an easy Christmas present or a little host gift.
Well, that's actually
on your way through the airport.
It's true. I was just there leaving to go to Las Vegas to visit my brother and sister-in-law and my little niece, and I was like, well, this is the perfect store to go into because there's something for everyone as you're traveling out of town.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always try to carry one of my books with me, and I don't know if you still have my books or not. I haven't looked in a while, but I have bought more of my books at Made in Washington because I forget my darn book and I'm on my way to an event or something like that. So that's anyway,
awesome.
We're here to talk smoked salmon here with Mike. And I have a lovely plate, a biodegradable plate of different types of salmon that I'm assuming came from your shop.
It did. This is the Smokehouse Tasting Flight. It's from our Sea Bear Smokehouse up in Anacortes. And much like a wine flight or a artisan brew flight, it's an opportunity to experience a different taste of the smokehouse. We started it up in Anacortes, super popular. People love to kind of – it's kind of a way to tour the smokehouse without touring the smokehouse, mm-hmm. right? And so we've exported it now down to the newly remodeled Pike Place Market Made in Washington store. And people from all over the country, we hope, will be able to learn a little bit about Northwest smoked salmon and how it compares to some of the other smoked salmon they might be used to. What you have in front of you, it has five different tastes from the smokehouse. We start with the lox and then go to a Pacific Northwest smoked salmon so people get that side-by-side comparison right up front.
So one is cold and one is hot.
One. So and that's all described in this little card that goes behind it. But the first one is it's cold smoked, mm-hmm. and that's our Girard & Dominique brand of lox.
Right.
And so most
super
people,
good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yep. And most people around the country, as I'm sure you guys know, when they think of smoked salmon, that's what they think of. Right? Lox
right.
equals smoked salmon. But particularly the visitors to this area, it's wonderful to then have them go to the next one on the plate here, which is the iconic taste of the Northwest, Pacific Northwest smoked salmon. Hot smoked, fully cooked, moist, flaky, and it's very, very unknown to a lot of the people who come through, and they taste them
delicious.
Side by side, and they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And lox is great, too, but it's a whole different culinary experience
just,
for them.
It's different texture. Yeah. It's different temperature. It's just a whole different product.
Whole different product.
Yeah.
And one you're tasting is our new garlic lovers. So mm-hmm. that's a sockeye salmon, brined in garlic, basted with some garlic olive oil, and then topped with garlic. So mm-hmm. it's for the garlic lover. So that's side-by-side.
It's funny, you don't really think about smoked fish coming in a more multiple flavors
yeah.
in a way, but
mm-hmm.
that's an interesting mm-hmm. concept.
Mm-hmm. And it's very good. You kept the moisture, which is really hard to find.
Oh, great. You like
and
that.
You see a lot of those smoked salmon to go on the market.
Yeah.
Those could go around the wood for a week and never, you know, they'd be fine because they're so dry.
Too
and so
dry.
Smoked.
That's exactly right. And we believe in smoking them lightly. We don't want the smoke to overpower the fish.
Right.
And we don't
right.
want to dry it down too much either.
Correct.
We think the salmon should be celebrated, whether it's lox or Pacific Northwest. You go to the next on the tasting flight, it's a smoked scallop. And this is another Girard & Dominique creation. And so this takes the same hot smoking approach that we use on the Pacific Northwest smoked salmon and applies it to an Alaskan weather vane scallop. And this is something virtually nobody who comes into the stores has tasted before. And it's one of our favorites at the smokehouse.
It's delicious.
When we bring this out to retailers and food service accounts, they call it seafood candy. It's great as it is. But if you throw it in a little pan with olive oil for 10 to 15 seconds, it caramelizes a little bit on the outside, and it's even better.
It's also good just like this sliced on the salad of any kind. I mean, it's
bingo.
A nice little –
it's
definitely
great,
a nice garnish.
Great on salads, spinach salads particularly. We have people toss it with pasta. A chef in California just sent us a picture of he makes a flatbread white pizza with this and shrimp. You know, there's lots
that
of
ways that would be delicious.
Once. All right. Next in our tasting row, halibut mousse.
Halibut, smoked halibut mousse.
I've never had a halibut mousse. It's like surf and turf, having halibut and mousse all at the same
see,
time.
See how easy we make it for you, Tom? All
they
in
the,
one easy
they
bite.
They the best of Alaska.
And served on a beach's
surf
cracker.
And turf. That's delicious. That mousse is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Nice texture, and it's also good. They kept the flavor and integrity of the fish.
Yes, without
really
it being
nice.
Overpowering is
right.
what we've shot for there. And that's another one that's great cold, but also you could heat it up and serve it as a hot mousse. And the final is something we're really excited about. We call it our smokehouse slider. It takes four iconic flavors of the Northwest. Sea Bear smoked salmon, Mama Lil's. I'm sure there's some Mama Lil's fans
mm-hmm.
around the table. Walla Walla sweet onion mustard, and puts it on an essential baking potato bun.
Lovely.
Isn't that a cool combination of flavors?
Yeah, I was concerned that the pepper was going to overwhelm it, but it's the whole thing is matched up beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are that's a taste that we started up in the smokehouse, and it's now what we serve in every one of our meetings. I mean, we've kind of fallen in love with it.
Mm-hmm. So can someone buy this in the store and take it with them?
They can buy all of these in the store. So the first four are refrigerated,
right.
and we have a case there to sell it out of there, or we can ship it for them. And the last one is no refrigeration required, and we sell the kits to be able to make them.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure, Mike, you'll agree with the chefs and myself when you are a local to Seattle. Sometimes, you know, you forget, maybe some people forget about the Pike Place Market because they think it's the place to bring family members or when right. visitors are in town. But having just strolled through the market this past weekend, I will say it is so much fun to rediscover it over and over and over again. And what a fun thing to do to come visit your store and try this flight.
Absolutely. We think the market on a number of levels is so great for mm-hmm. locals, right? And that and that's this is meant for not just visitors at all, mm-hmm. but for locals also. We just had a little kickoff party, and there was a lot of locals there. And what they said at the end wasn't just, oh, that was delicious, it was
yeah.
fun, but I learned something. Mm-hmm. And that is important to us, too. We want to make this more than just tasting great food, but learning about great food and being able to really celebrate what's great about the Northwest.
Yes.
You know, I think there is plenty to celebrate in this part of the world. So mm-hmm. that's why I'm still here after 30 years.
I think it's interesting when people think about smoked salmon. The question I get the most is, how do you brine it? You know, mm-hmm. that is something that is a little bit of a concern for people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they get the whole smoking part, but
yeah.
it's still an enigma of part of the process. And so I think what has shown here today is that your brine has to match up with your smoke, right?
Exactly.
If it's overly salty or overly sweet, it doesn't really work.
Exactly.
But if it matches
and
up with
for the species of fish.
And yeah, exactly. Perfect.
We just want to make sure to say that if you want to try this tasting flight, which is super, super delicious, happy to have this in the morning as a treat, you can go to the Made in Washington store in the Pike Place Market. If you mention Seattle Kitchen, you can get the flight for free.
It's usually $5, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Mm, yes.
Come on down all month. Mention Seattle Kitchen, and we'll give it to you for free.
The whole month. That is four more weeks.
Free?
We can go down. Does that mean we can go down there every day and have
every
this
day.
Flight?
We would
for
love
free.
To see you.
For 4 weeks, we can go down there every day.
Do we have to say 97.3 FM?
Thanks, Mike. That's Mike Mondello, Made in Washington, also the Sea Bear Smokehouse. Yeah.
Thank you.
Are a couple of in the same world. They
own
each other.
One in the same.
Up next, we're cooking up a storm of simple, delicious foods with chef, author, Dory Greenspan and her new cookbook, Everyday Dory, on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Hi, I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotrur, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
We are back in the kitchen here at the Hot Stove Society. No audience today. We'll just keep reminding you that they're not just mad at us, but they're just not here. So it's been a quiet day today on the show.
Hide from them.
Well, we had an event at the Hot Stove, so we had to move into another room, and that didn't take an audience. Anyway, Dory Greenspan is here. She's going to be teaching at the Hot Stove tonight, so you've missed her. But her book, Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook, is a tome. Welcome back to the show, Dory.
It's so great to be with you. Thank you.
And to Seattle.
I love being in Seattle.
What do you like about Seattle? When you are in New York and you're on the Lower East Side and you're thinking, I got to go to Seattle, is there something that pops into your head that you have to do while you're here?
It's not so much what I have to do. There's something about walking the streets here. It just feels so good. I love that people actually smile at you when mm-hmm. you make, you know, eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great feeling in this city.
You know, it's a quite a good walking city considering
yeah.
how hilly it is. I think that way of San Francisco, too, but most great walking cities like Paris or
yeah.
London or
quite flat.
New York
flat.
City,
yeah.
they're all
yeah.
flat, and it's easy to get around, and they have transit. Here, we're just out of it.
Well, but it's so much, you know, you kind of crest one of the hilly streets, and then you see the water.
Mm-hmm.
I love this place.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be back.
And I would suggest while you're here to take a rejuvenation stroll through the Pike Place Market.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that I always say that if you're going to design a city in this country and if you have a blank slate to work with, that I think many, many, many folks, many architects would start with the Pike Place Market in the core of their city. And we're just lucky enough to have it here.
Yeah, so. I can't imagine coming here and not visiting the market.
Yeah. yeah. Anyway, new book. Tell us about the Everyday Dory and the way you cook.
So it's my 13th book.
Holy
wow,
Bacon's
Dory.
Dozen. Tom, how many do you have now?
Four.
Oh.
Oh.
What
yeah.
have you been doing with
yeah. you? How many restaurants do you have, Dory?
Oh, you only have four.
So it's actually only my second, I call it like soup to dessert book because I do a lot of, you know, a lot of my work has been in baking and pastry. And somebody said to me, I didn't know you cooked. And I thought, really? I mean, you know, I'm a responsible adult. I've fed my family, you know, savory food before dessert. This is the last book that I did that was food was 2010. Mm-hmm. And working on this book was so – I didn't realize this until I finished it. Over those 8 years, we'd been spending more time in rural Connecticut where I didn't have Pike Place Market. I didn't have the open-air markets of Paris, which is – you know, my other hometown. I had the supermarket. Uh-huh. And I was an hour round trip from it. And so when I looked at the recipes, it was interesting to see that my cooking had changed. I'd become a simpler, more practical cook. Mm-hmm. You know, just trying to like grab as much flavor as I could out mm-hmm. of the ingredients that I could, you know, get at the market and everything that I had on my fridge door.
Did you grow anything?
I have a small garden and I can grow herbs. I travel too much to, you know. I did once have a tomato that would have been good and had I, you know, been able to keep the garden until November.
That's so sad.
Yeah, I almost once had one tomato.
Yeah. I wrote a book just for that tomato.
We used to lament about that here in this town, but with global warming, we've had beautiful dry summers, warm heat, and good tomato weather. And, of course, so where our farm is in eastern Washington, it's blisteringly hot in the midsummer, mm-hmm. and sometimes so hot that it drops all the tomato blossoms. So careful what you wish for. So, favorites. What, you know, I think of our listeners as being in their cars right now, of being in their gardens, shutting it down for the winter. What's a good, you know, Seattle's got that kind of moist chill in the air. What are some good dinners, fall dinners?
So before I headed off on book tour, I made dinner for eight. And we started with oven-charred tomato-stuffed peppers. And so I love when I can, like, tuck a surprise into something. So these are bell peppers sliced the long way. And when you see them, you just see halved cherry tomatoes arranged. You know, it's like an arts and crafts project, arranged over the top. But there's an underlayer of breadcrumbs with herbs and lemon zest and anchovies. Which just adds a little pop to it, and you mm-hmm. don't see it, so you just get to taste that. And I love this dish because it looks so pretty when it goes into the oven. You have that wonderful moment of, look what I made. Mm-hmm. But you can prepare it ahead. It can be served hot, warm, or room temperature. I love room temperature dishes. So we had that first. We had this. Tom, you're going to have to look it up for me. Page 149.
I love that she loves the page number. Well, that's a woman who knows her work.
Well, no. It's the only page number I know because I gave this stew such a long title that I can't remember anything but the page number.
It's called Subtly Spicy, Softly Hot, Slightly Sweet Beef Stew.
The stew on page 149.
Mm-hmm. That's the one.
So it started as a kind of classic French stew. I had beef cubes that were going to marinate in red wine. And then I opened the fridge door, and there was gochujang, the Korean mm-hmm. chili paste, mm-hmm. which seemed like a great addition with yeah. red wine, and ginger and star anise, and it kind Yum. Of took off. And then pears, poached pears for dessert. So that turned out to be a great dinner.
Mm-hmm. This particular picture shows that it might have an oxtail or some sort of saddle bone in it.
So if I can get an oxtail or a marrow bone, mm-hmm. a shank bone, I love to add that to mm-hmm. a stew. The oxtail has a little gelatinous, and the flavors are really mm-hmm. deeper, but I can't always get them.
And good fat, too.
And good fat. Yeah.
Now, we're in the middle of pear country. I don't know if you know that or not. But
the middle of?
Pear country.
Oh,
P-E-A-R,
of course. Yes. Yeah, of course.
And they are right now. They are perfect.
Okay,
right?
So two recipes.
Yeah.
The poached pears, I poach them in white wine. I usually see them in red, but I like the white because I think it allows the flavor of the pear to come out more, and you get to see how beautiful the pear is. And also, a caramel pear cake that has Chinese five spice flavoring it, and that's I think the Chinese five spice is really nice with pear.
You ever tried rub with love? Just kidding, Tom. You should.
I just made a Chinese five spice mochi donut as a base donut for a lot of different things, dried pineapple and freeze dried strawberries and things like that. But I do love that flavor, that five spice, and it works well. In one of my books, I have a five spice angel food cake. It's an ingredient that is fragrant and warm and floral, and there's just a lot going on there.
So I think of it in the family of garam masala and the pain de pisse, the spice powder. That same kind of, you described it so beautifully, that kind of warmth and little bit of spice and kind of mystery as well. You know, it's a blend that I think you taste it.
I'm a much bigger fan of that mix of spice than I am of just cinnamon. You know, very often when people use just cinnamon, I get a little bit turned off because I think that it's something that people use too much of.
I think it's too easy.
Yeah, and also they use too much of it. I think it's a little bit overpowering.
You must be French.
I'll give you that idea.
We're talking with Dori Greenspan. Her new book, Everyday Dori, The Way I Cook, is out in the marketplace. She's out on tour, and we're so thankful that you chose to come by and spend a little time with us and at the Hot Stove Society. Some of the cheers for the books, pretty impressive on the back. Yoda Matulangi calls her a guru. Christopher Kimball, we all know from America's Test Kitchen, right? Isn't that his show?
Milk Street now.
Yeah. David Leibowitz, of course, probably you see him in Paris all the time.
He's not quite a neighbor, but yeah.
And Christina Tosi from the Milk Bar, Mama Fuko Milk Bar. Lots of great endorsements. Chef Terry and I, we agree.
We agree 100%. Always.
Thank you.
It's always fun to visit with you because the breadth of your work history and books is so amazing, right? 13 books over how many years? We're not even going to talk about that part.
We don't have to talk about years.
But you've been at the top of your field for so long that it's very impressive.
Thank you. You know, I feel like I'm really lucky to do this work. I love this work.
Good.
So glad to do it.
It shows.
All right, Dori Greenspan, go out and try the book, Everyday Dori, The Way I Cook. Up next, it's Beaujolais Nouveau time.
Oh, is it that time of the year again?
It's that time of the year where we get to drink kind of raw wine.
Fresh.
We're going to have to
see. Some people call it fresh. I consider it more raw.
We're going to have to see again, once again, if we like it.
All right. Jack Cowan is here to tell us what to expect with this year's event on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show here at the Hot Stove Society. We are live without an audience today, so you're not going to hear the adorable people in the background applauding.
Wait a minute. You guys want to applaud?
Yeah, okay.
I see Sean isn't participating in clapping. Yeah. Interesting.
That's why we call him Del Torre. It's time to talk Beaujolais Nouveau for the 26th time here in Seattle. There's going to be a Beaujolais Nouveau party, and Mr. Jack is going to tell us all about it. Jack Cowan is here on Cairo. What's going on?
So I'm Jack Cowan. I'm the executive director of the French American Chamber of Commerce, and we're doing our 26th annual Beaujolais Nouveau Wine Festival at the Columbia Tower Club. It'll be on November 16th from 7 to 11. It's a walking around wine and food tasting. We've got a lot of great French wines, some Washington wines too, and a lot of great local food as well as some French food. So you've got a real Northwest vibe in the event.
It must be open to the public.
Yes, it's open to the public, and you can go to our webpage at www.faccpnw.org and buy tickets. So we have young professionals. If you're under 35, there's a special rate. We've got a few of those left. We've got some general admission tickets left. We're sold out of VIPs.
Isn't that funny? The VIPs always go first. Why don't you just make all the tickets VIP?
Right, exactly.
So everyone feels very important.
Yeah, but if you're a young professional and don't have big bucks and don't work for Amazon, it's nice to have a cheaper ticket.
There you go. So it's also a great chance to get up there and look out from the Columbia Tower Club up there on the 73rd floor?
75th right? and 76th.
Wow. I'm a member there. I didn't even know that. So
what?
Yeah.
Oh, Tom.
Years ago, I didn't
Kitty,
there.
Kitty, why are you so surprised?
They made me an honorary member, and I'm still a member.
Well, let's go and have a Beaujolais party.
Let's do it. Okay, so, Chef. Chef
yes, sir.
Poe. Jack is here, and annually we talk about the new vintage 2018. Have you had it yet?
No.
It
doesn't come out.
He can't.
Because you can't. Not here? There's not even a bottle here yet?
No.
Well, there might be a bottle en route, but there's no bottle that you can drink.
So it's on an airplane on the way here?
Right? Yes.
Wow.
It comes in by airplane the 12th of November.
Oh. No, the day before, the 15th, the third Thursday in November.
Yeah. Oh, the 15th, not the 12th. Yeah, you're right. It's actually the third Thursday, not the date.
So that's a traditional release
date? Right.
Mm-hmm. A week before Thanksgiving.
It lands in New York, Chicago, Miami, and then San Francisco and Seattle.
Did you know this, KDO?
I recall some of these informative tidbits from years prior of having Jack on the show, but it is always kind of a surprising thing to think of something that we commonly see on the shelves in wine shops and grocery stores that has this very, very specific release date, and it comes on one particular day.
It reminds me of Copper River Salmon. The marketing behind Beaujolais Nouveau has been unbelievable worldwide, and they've made this into a very traditional day around the planet. I mean, pretty much all the way to Tokyo, all the way back to Paris. I mean, it's an incredible thing that they've done. They've marketed to a T.
Let's talk to the listeners out there who maybe haven't caught this segment before about Beaujolais and what makes it so special and why we get excited for its release every year.
It's not just Beaujolais Nouveau.
It's Beaujolais, right?
It's Beaujolais Nouveau.
Pardon
it's
me.
Very important
Beaujolais
to say Nouveau. Because Nouveau is not
the new
yet.
Stuff.
It's not yet a wine.
It's a new
it's
wine.
It's not
new
finished wine. The fermentation yet. It still has a little tiny fizzante to it, so it's not quite a wine yet. The Beaujolais, which you find later on in the year from different wineries or different villages through the Rhône Valley, are different. You know, this is something. It's a celebration of the harvest. Is how it started, right, Jack?
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right on.
Anyway, so it's a celebration of the harvest. When the wine was still brand new in the cistern and the vast and whatever you call it, all those different barrels that they use, and the wine is not actually finished to ferment yet.
And you get excited, so you crack it open.
And it's delicious because it tastes like a very good grape juice / wine. So it's a cut between the grape juice and the wine. So
very fruity.
Very fruity.
Very, very fruity.
And typically inexpensive, too.
Yes.
Very inexpensive, yes. And it's a Gamay grape. That's the main grape of Beaujolais. And for the Beaujolais Nouveau, and it's very fruity of a wine. So
Chef, if you were up there working the Columbia Tower Club this night on the 16th of November, what would you be serving with your Beaujolais Nouveau? What do you think is the perfect match food wise?
Well, you know, it's Beaujolais Nouveau, Beaujolais in general, which is, as I said, a Gamay grape in most cases, pretty fruity forward kind of wine, is usually served with meat. In general, like red, like for example, a Boeuf Bourguignon can be served with a Beaujolais Nouveau.
And we'll be serving that at the Columbia Tower Club, Boeuf Bourguignon.
No, unbeknownst to me, but you know, somehow it matches.
Onion soup, like or salami.
If you were doing cured meat goes well with that kind of fruit. The good thing about a Beaujolais, after it's been Beaujolais Nouveau, then it becomes a wine. Once it's a wine that is easy to match with a lot of meat. In general, grilled meat goes really well with it. Mm-hmm. Like a steak frites with a little Bordelaise sauce on it would go really well with a glass of Beaujolais.
And what are the qualities within the Gamay, within the Beaujolais Nouveau or the Beaujolais, that make it so well suited for these dishes? I think that's
fruit.
I think the
fruit forward and the acid that's behind it. So both of those components are pretty much the highlights of the wine. So the acid makes it go well with fatty food.
Mm-hmm. Cuts like right through. Mm-hmm.
And then the fruit is great to go with acid food, so it cuts right through. So you have a balance of, you know, anytime you have a big, rich red wine sauce or something like this, it actually goes really well with it. And it's also traditionally, because it's inexpensive and they have a huge volume of that wine, it's usually the wine that makes it as a red wine to a lot of the bistros and cafes in Paris and all around the country. as the house wine or the wine by the glass that is the most commonly found in France.
Yeah, and the number one French wine sold in Washington State actually is Beaujolais Village.
So, oh, I would never have guessed that.
Yeah.
One of the things I love to do with wine especially, and I've not really tried it with Beaujolais Nouveau, is I like to really try to match a cheese from the exact area of from where the wine is. Are there famous cheeses that somebody could go buy?
Well, I think the sheep cheese of the Rhone Valley, you know, I can't even think of a name right off the top of my head, but there's definitely plenty of cheese of sheep and goat during the Rhone Valley that really matches with a Beaujolais.
Okay.
Especially... again, Beaujolais Nouveau is a specific kind of wine, so you know it's more about the celebration mm-hmm. of the new harvest than anything else. But the Beaujolais itself provides some wine like Saint Joseph and many different other type of appellation that are really good with that kind of cheese. You know, nice creamy with a little fuerte in the background. You know, a little strength of cheese in the background, like a nice sheep cheese. That's
because there's a whole bunch of Beaujolais Crus, which would be like Morgon,
or Fleury, Moulin-en-Vent.
Moulin-en-Vent, yeah. That's a well-known one.
Nice accent, Tom.
So what I would say is if you can't make it, we hope that you show up at the Columbia Tower Club. The French-American Chamber of Commerce certainly hopes. And if you go to their website, you can buy a ticket. But it's also fun to go to, say, Pike and Western Wine Shop. Our buddy Mike is down there. Buy three different three different Nouveaux, and have a little party and share them with each other and enjoy the taste and with some local cheese. And
make a nice little stew and then have it with friends.
I have something I'm going to shock Thierry with, though. They've come out with a different Beaujolais Nouveau this year, Beaujolais Nouveau Rosé.
You know what? Good for them. That's all I'm going to say. Good for them.
Yeah, it doesn't even sit on the skins very long, unless they're just
white
wine.
It's not even
the
wine, but it's also barely on the skin.
Say the website one more time before.
So it's www.faccpnw.org.
French American Chamber of Commerce, Pacific Northwest.org. And we're going to put it on our Facebook page. Up next, it's our favorite taste of the week, both at home and around town, right here on Kiowa Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. It's time for the second hour of our show, and I'm excited about that because we still have we're going to learn how to taste. Becky Selengut is here, and she has a new book out called How to Taste, so we're going to jump into that. We're going to talk to Brittany Bartleben, the chef at Dahlia Bakery, and do some holiday dessert making, and of course, food for thought tasty trivia.
Mm-hmm.
I got crushed last week, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I lost last week.
Favorite taste of the week. Katie, you seem excited to jump into this.
I am. You know, this segment was really born out of something that we all do anyway, which is come in and talk about the things that we have eaten over the past week that we are so excited about. But one comes from someone that we all know and love here at the show, which is Darby Reed. Do you know Darby Reed? Everyone knows Darby.
Who's Darby? I don't know.
Oh, you don't. Don't do that because she's going to hear this and then be so sad, Tom.
I might have a little crush on her. So, I don't know that for a fact.
Don't let Colin, her husband, hear that. You don't want him jealous. But she is such a wonderful home cook. You know, she's got a full-time job, but has a real passion for the kitchen. And she was like, let's get together, have a little tea and cookies. And she made me, you know, these cookies to take home with me. And because I'm an animal, I had to eat one in the car on the drive away. And it was so delicious. And so I texted her back and said,
well, you're
what
not an
you
animal
do?
Unless you arrived home with none of them.
That's
left.
True. Yeah. I did still have some cookies for later. But
it was
reminded
a
me,
drive.
It reminded me of our show where we take things from ordinary to extraordinary. She took a recipe, a regular Toll House recipe, but used better chocolate. She browned the butter and then she finished it with like a really nice crispy flaky salt. And the salt is what made it irresistible when I was eating it because it was really balancing all those heavier, more luscious, buttery, chocolatey notes of the cookie. Ugh. It's just a real big fan. It's my taste of the week. Mm. Plus it was made with love. And you like, again, as people that love food, it is so sweet to have someone make something for you like that and send you away.
There wasn't any direction from her from Miss Darby to maybe share some with your radio team?
Nope. Nope.
I'm going to ask her
What'll happen is she'll feel guilted and probably make you your own batch. But no, she did not tell me to share mine.
Chef Terry, what was your taste of the week?
I got to say the whole experience. My assistant had a birthday this week, and I took her out to Matt's in the Market. We had lunch there, and I forgot, and I just remember now how great the city is. And if you have never been to Seattle, I think it's a restaurant you must be sitting at that window and overlook that gorgeous Pike Place Market sign and that clock and the people throwing the fish. You can see all that from your seat. And it's just, I think it's a very beautiful place in Seattle to go to for lunch. Mm-hmm. And the food was delicious. So we had something I've never, or I haven't had in a long time, which was 6 half devil egg, which I thought that was pretty a big amount of devil.
That's
egg.
A lot of egg for an appetizer.
Thank God we were sharing, so that wasn't too hard. But what I like the most about those devil eggs is they make the devil egg to go back into the egg white, but also they put a topping on each one of those. So one was octopus, one was crab, one was anchovies, one, I mean, it was a very delicious selection of 6 different half hard boiled egg, which... It's very hard to recommend devil egg to anybody, but I would definitely recommend it. Mm-hmm. And a big bowl of clam and mussel, steamed, in a beautiful white wine broth. Ooh. Fresh herbs, finish at the end. It was done absolutely exactly how it should be, as in all the shellfish was nice and tender, not overcooked. I mean, I give it a great thumb up for making it a very special experience in terms of being sitting at that window with a glass of champagne and looking over Pike Place Market. I think anybody from Seattle who hasn't done that in a while should do it, because it reminds us why we have the Pike Place Market and why it is such an important part of our city.
Mm-hmm. And our buddy Matt Fortner is the chef there now. Yeah. So his wife is our pastry chef at the Dahlia Workshop.
Tom, what was your taste?
My taste of the week was during the Sagra di Verdicchio, and I missed your ice cream. Yes, I did.
Brittany Bartolet,
I have more, Mike.
So I didn't get to try the Verdicchio ice cream or the chicory ice cream, but I did get to try. I was down at London Plain with Tony and Jen, our chefs over at Serious Pie Virginia, and they did a beautiful Verdicchio and delicata squash pie that was very tasty. But I think the more than that taste itself was the celebration of the vegetable, that is chicory in all of its different forms. And I would like to see more of that here in Seattle. A couple of things I really liked about that taste. One is that it was delicious, and I got to really understand chicory in a different way. Mm-hmm. The second is we need to do more chefy things in this town.
Absolutely.
We need to do more things where we get together as chefs, talk about food, celebrate it with our customers in a whole different kind of way.
Correct.
Be thoughtful about it when it comes to the farmers and utilizing not just the big round head of Verdicchio like you see in Spring Mix and all the things at the store, but all the variations I thought was a really healthy way to think about farming. And these guys at Local Roots certainly focus a ton on these chicories. So the other thing I did to celebrate that is I bought Brittany, jump on the mic there for a second. I bought those posters that graphic artist had done.
They're beautiful.
Aren't they amazing?
Yeah, they're awesome. I want one.
I know. Yeah. If I could think of the name right now, darn it. You should go online, or maybe if you just go online and do Sagra. So Sagra means celebration in Italian, celebration of Verdicchio. So if you go online, you can probably come up with those posters.
I saw the poster on Facebook, I think.
Yeah, they are fantastic. That guy is super talented. Yeah. And I loved them. So.
Yeah, it looks very cool.
Yeah, that was my taste
but you're
the
right,
whole
Tom,
weekend.
It, celebrating more of vegetables and fruits of the region amongst chefs is definitely a great goal. I mean, I think it's very cool.
Yeah, and
And again, bitter is not a flavor than a lot of Americans are used to. It's still a very new flavor in terms of the diet than we have. Mm-hmm. You know, we're more sweet and salty, so... Bitter, I think it's a great, beautiful thing to celebrate.
And
I love an endive gratin. I know you love a gratin.
Such a French thing.
But it is a French thing, but you know, cheese and endive melted together.
One of the chefs made a beautiful radicchio amare.
Amaro.
So there's all sorts of ways to do it. Anyway.
Yeah.
It was super good fun, and I'm glad that my wife. Congrats to my wife for helping to put that on. It was awesome. Up next, chef author Becky Selengut is here to talk about how we taste on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotaro, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And we have another author with us today. We're full of fun guests today.
Star power.
Mm-hmm. Just back from Tokyo. We're the first ones to see you, right?
Oh, definitely. I'm the first. You're the first people I'm seeing.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's a bad
My eyes are just opening.
That's a bad wake up one.
We're going to talk with Becky Selengut, who teaches us how to taste. Last time I think we had you on the show.
Yeah. For shroom.
Was it shroom or salmon? Shroom.
Yeah.
Okay. This seems like a little out of order.
Ah.
So how to taste now after you've written a few books. We should have how to taste and then write a few books.
That's because that she realized that's how you increase your book sales.
Exactly.
Is by making people know how to taste.
So tell us about this book and the theory behind it and how you got started down this path. And
so I was teaching a cooking class and I was seasoning a soup that my students had made. And I took a taste and I added a little salt and I added a little bit of lime. And then I added a couple drops of fish sauce. And when I turned around, all the students said, "Now, Chef, that's the class we want to take, not all the other classes. Mm-hmm. We want to learn to know exactly what was going on inside your palate." And I'm like, "Well, that's impossible. That, 20 years in the career, maybe you can do that." And then I'm like, "Well, that's a really unsatisfying thing to say to students when you're a teacher." So then
that's impossible. Yeah.
You'll never get it.
And then I was like, "Well, this is a huge challenge and I want to take this on." So how do you teach home cooks how to know exactly when it needs salt for their palate, or why is acidity important, or how can texture really be a game changer? What is umami, and how is bitter not just bad but something good to add complexity? And then getting into all the other nuances that chefs know about that we don't really teach necessarily in cooking school, like color and shape and emotion and who you're dining with and why booze is important, not just for the conviviality, but also what it does chemically. And so getting into a lot of the science as well as teaching people what kind of tasters they are, because not everybody has the same genetics and the same palate. So getting people to understand, just like you do in a wine class, how it is that you can become a better taster. And we teach this about wine, but we don't actually teach this in culinary school about taste. So it was a deep dive for me into the science and then also in practically making it approachable to home cooks.
So what is the first step that one would take in order to improve on their taste?
First thing, Terry, thank you for asking, is to know what kind of taster you are. So we talk about super tasters being such a wonderful thing, but actually it's not so wonderful. And I know this because someone we know in common, my wife April, who's your GM, is a super taster. And that makes her very, very good at discerning wine. But she actually is pretty picky because she's got a dense mat of taste buds that make her very, very sensitive to imbalances in bitter and acidity. She needs more salt in her food to counteract that bitterness that makes her not like certain vegetables and all these other things. Now, if you're the other side of the bell curve, 25% of the population, you're a tolerant taster, which means that you're sort of going through the world like, "Hey, I'm fine with everything, but I need a lot of salt and I need a lot of spice." So anyone you know in your life who's just dumping hot sauce and salt on all their food probably has way less taste buds. And then you have the average tasters, 50% of the population. Most chefs are average tasters. I'm going to guess that you guys are too. I am. And it means we love food. We have slight pickiness here and there, but in general, you want to cook for average tasters because it's the biggest part of the population. And if you're a tolerant taster, you want to add more salt and hot sauce and back off when you're serving other people. And if you're a super taster, do your damn best because it's going to be real hard. It's going to be real hard.
And that's got to be totally related directly to the same thing with smell. I mean, people.
You would think, but it's not actually.
No,
there's no correlation that they found between your sense of smell and your genetics of your taste
buds. But I thought that if you squeeze your nostril, well, you couldn't smell it. You couldn't taste anything.
That is true. And we're going to do a little experiment to get into that. But it's not relevant to whether you're a super taster or a non-taster.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean.
But yeah, I love teaching this thing. And I was hoping we had time to get you guys to do this jelly bean test because it's really cool.
I love jelly beans.
Yeah.
I love tests.
Okay. Let's do it. Okay. Yeah. Let's jump into it. Okay. So I have a jelly bean in front of all of you. Doesn't matter what color it is or whatever.
Oh, I had mine already. Sorry.
Oh, okay. God, Terry.
Did you really?
Terry totally did.
Jeez.
So
I the second one.
What I like teaching students is that people always try and think about like, oh, aromatics and like herbs and spices are the most important thing in cooking. But the truth is that most of our, the most important balancing is in your mouth. And that's the salt, sweet, acid, umami, bitter. And if you have any of your sense of smell shut down, like when you have a cold, you really can't appreciate things at all. So we really need to do what wine experts do, which is called, very nerdily, retronasal breathing, breathing in our mouth and then out our nose and pushing the air out to get the full experience. So if you do that right now with me, it's kind of dorky, but just breathe in and then breathe out the
without
nose.
Without the jelly bean?
Without the jelly bean. I want you to just practice so no one aspirates a jelly bean. Close down your mouth, breathe out your nose. Okay. So if you pinch off your nose completely and don't even breathe in your nose, shallow mouth breathing, put that jelly bean in your mouth, chew a couple times. I'm going to lead you guys through it. Chew a couple times, pinch down your nose completely. You don't get very much, maybe sweet, maybe a little bit acidic. Now open your nose and then send that air out your nose.
So fun. Wow.
Right?
So, I'm only going to eat jelly beans from now on.
So I personally think this was a Harry Potter earwax jelly.
It was not. It was vomit.
So mine is chocolate.
Yeah.
I didn't even taste the chocolate when I was closing my nose.
No, you don't.
And when I breathed out, it was totally chocolate.
Because there's no taste bud receptor for chocolate. Mm-hmm. You just have sweet and acidity. So did you guys get a little bit of sweetness maybe and get the texture?
Yeah, sweetness and a little bit of acid. That's about it.
So when you have a cold, people are always like, increase the aromatics and increase. It's like, no, increase the umami, increase the fat, increase the sweetness, increase the salt. Mm-hmm. Do everything in the mouth you possibly can to distract yourself from the fact that you get no flavor.
Right.
So
and you can't breathe.
You can't breathe.
So, it concerns me so much with all this salt talk, right? Because I watch young cooks all the time. You know, they'll be working all night long on the line at the restaurant. And, you know, by the time they've tasted a dish 30, 40, 50 times, even 100 times they might taste a dish in the night, they always add more salt. And I think that you get palate fatigue for salt, and then you end up sometimes the last customers of the night are the ones who get the brunt of the salt hit.
Yes. Yeah, always good to have someone not necessarily a line cook taste the food and give you a feedback on the salt. And especially if your cooks are smokers, they're going to have deadened taste buds and probably oversalt. So I always want to hold back a little on the salt. Always, for me, I like to provide salt to the table to all my guests. Too. So let them be that, because you don't know what kind of taster they are.
And then where do people go when it comes to, like, we only have a couple of minutes left, but you know, right now it's apple season, pear season, right? In the stores, you're seeing 20 different kinds of apples. Where would you suggest somebody go with an apple tasting? You know, we had a smoked salmon tasting earlier. To get to their special spot, do you hold your nose and get the sweetness that you like, or do you...
Oh, interesting. I think that would be a great start, just to isolate the acidity and the sweetness, and then really see what that, just with a wine, to really get that, or the jelly bean, to get that burst of flavor, and then really identify what is this apple doing palate-wise and also aromatics. That would be fun.
Is it the same with proteins and fats? Can you smell and taste through those?
Not so much. Not nearly as much as with the aromatics.
Okay.
So, like, apples definitely have that high level of aromatics going on.
Interesting. So the book is called How to Taste. Becky Selengut is here. The Curious Cook's Handbook to Seasoning and Balance from Umami to Acid and Beyond. And it's got recipes, too. So exciting.
And experiments.
And
like the jelly bean experiment?
Like the jelly bean experiment?
Yeah, and a bunch more, like a Manhattan experiment, which is really fun.
I feel like, Becky, once you get over your jet lag, you and I should get together and have
and do the Manhattan experiment. Yeah, so the experiment is we drink six and then we forget what the experiment was.
That's so fun. I love that experiment.
I'm really good at it.
You only remember the beginning of the night.
Up next, it's the Baker's Corner here at the Seattle Kitchen. Brittany Bartleben from the Dolly Bakery is going to join us and talk holiday season cooking on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the kitchen. It's the Baker's Corner time here in the Seattle Kitchen Show at the Hot Stove Society. Brittany Bartleben, pastry chef at the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge, is here to talk about... Well, last week we did pumpkin pie, but
we
this week you have another pie on your mind.
The pumpkin pie is a whole show.
Yeah, I should say that, and we should say that for the next couple of weeks. If you are thinking about your Thanksgiving pumpkin pie, just podcast your segment from last week. We went at it top to bottom.
We really did.
And I've been thinking about it ever since. Yes.
And just as a side note, I've already made the dough for my quince.
Good on ya. Yeah.
Tart.
Guys, Thanksgiving's like what, 2 weeks away?
And so I made the dough yesterday and put it in the freezer. And I'm going to make a quince because I have all these quince and I need to process them. And
it's
I'm going to put them sliced ready in the freezer. And then the day of, I'm going to make that tart. I already have a pineapple and quince puree.
Ooh.
I'm going to put it on the bottom. Oh, I'm going to have a delicious quince
Yum.
Pie.
Let's
I do
not
love
get
quince.
Ahead of ourselves. We'll be the judge. Whether
exactly.
You be the judge or maybe not.
When you bring it in next week.
If there is any left, I'll bring some
we'll
in.
We'll be the judge.
Okay.
Mr. Big Talker.
That's right.
Oh, it's going to be delicious.
Hey, if you don't give yourself flour, nobody else might give it to them.
Okay, Ms. Bartleben, you came in with an agenda today.
I am. I'm going to make something for my Thanksgiving table that I have not made for Thanksgiving before. I discovered this pie a couple of months ago for our Food Lovers Weekend, and that is a shoo fly pie. Mm-hmm. And I told myself when I made it, I am definitely making this over the holidays because it tastes like a ginger snap cookie, one of those soft molasses cookies in a pie crust. And it is absolutely delicious. Nothing could be easier. The ingredients are a partially baked pie crust.
Just a
regular pie crust, molasses, boiling water, and baking soda. That's your filling.
That's it?
That's it. And then you make like a crumble topping. It's flour, butter, little sugar, little spices that you just pulse up in your food processor and just scatter that over your liquid, pop the whole thing in the oven and forget about it for a little while. And it just melds in to this. It's the texture of a cookie, a soft molasses cookie.
It's just a sugar filling. Then.
It's just a sugar. Yeah, that's it.
And molasses is sugar, right? Sugar. Yeah,
exactly. So have you all heard of like a treacle tart?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's basically the same thing using Lyle's golden syrup. It's a European version of it. This is what the Pennsylvania Dutch created to use up the things they had in their larder, and it turned out to be something delicious, and it became sort of, I mean, I guess you would call it a cult classic, but a lot of people.
Why is it called shoo fly?
It's actually named after the molasses. There's two schools of thought. It's either because it's so sticky sweet that it's shoo fly, but it's that's an assumption. It's actually based off the shoo fly brand molasses.
Oh.
Yeah. Originally,
so, you know, that happens so often in that era where even condensed milk, or they would come with a recipe, or the Domino powdered sugar box had an icing recipe, and then it became family standards.
Exactly. Yeah. And I fell in love with this pie, and it's so easy.
I'm so interested. I want you to break down your love affair with it, because I don't get it. You're such a fine baker, right? And you just made this chicory ice cream for the Sagra di Radicchio. Why does a simple thing like that? I mean, it's not like it's not delicious. I'm not saying I wouldn't eat it. I'm just saying, but you are intensely...
Yes, at work.
Intense about it.
This doesn't surprise me at all.
When I'm at home, I love old recipes, old Americana. Mm-hmm. I love recipes that speak to my heart. You know, growing up, my grandmother's kitchen was just very simple. She just called it good old country cooking. And so those are the things that I love to have at home. I like to bring out the trashy recipes that actually got me in the kitchen when I was a kid, like with the Jell-O. And so that's what I like to do at home. I also don't like to spend too much time in the kitchen at home. I like to quickly create something delicious and then get out and be with my family.
So you become just one of our listeners.
As opposed to
Brittany, the pastry chef at Tom.
Exactly,
a regular person.
Because I also want to be in my extra loose jammy pants in front of the TV.
And you want to spend time.
Exactly, yeah.
I always think, you know, my first thing is, how do I make this better, right? And that's a fault of mine. And I'd say it really comes out when I'm trying to do, like if I'm doing Cuban food or something like that. I'm always trying to adjust somebody else's ethnic tradition.
Yes.
And it's so stupid of me. But that's kind of like, from my mind, the first thing I was thinking is like, well, do you want to add some pecans to the crust? Or do you want, what's going to make this better? But really, leaving it alone is what the tradition
is. Yeah, why mess with it? You want to have a really great butter pie crust, and you want to use fresh ingredients. And I just top it. I'm going to top it with just a really nice, softly whipped cream, not too sweet.
And you par-bake the dough, right?
You do par-bake the dough before putting your filling in. That is correct.
Katie, do you have a recipe like that, especially in the dessert area, that you just kind of crave, even though it's just as simple as could be?
Yeah, you know, funny, my mom a long time ago found a cookbook called the Black Family Reunion Cookbook. We're a Japanese-American family. It's obviously a big cross-cultural thing. But in that cookbook, there is a recipe for a peach custard pie that is so simple. But the peaches are essentially kind of floating in this custard. It all bakes at once. It's not difficult. The most difficult part with any pie is that buttery crust, mm-hmm. right? It's making sure that it's flaky and delicious. But that is something that still to this day we all love as a family.
Did it call for a can of cling peaches?
It did. It calls,
I know, isn't that funny?
It calls for canned peaches, and you use that same syrup mixed in with like a buttermilk egg mixture. And that's what makes it kind of easy, is that you're not, you know,
you're not inventing
grabbing
the wheel.
You're not reinventing the wheel.
That's
but
right.
I think you feel the same way, and Tira, I know you do, and I know Brittany does for sure, is that there is something about, I mean, we of course want to use the freshest, most beautiful stuff all the time. Definitely want to promote that. But there is something about the tradition of using things that have been used for a really long time over generations and recipes that are built upon that predication of times when maybe, you know, you didn't have as much. It was a little bit more lean, or you had to go to the pantry because peaches weren't available all year round.
Kind of like my mom's Philly cream cheesecake. You know, she always made the cheesecake off the back of the box of the Philadelphia cream cheese. And I love that. A little sour, sweet and sour cream on top.
Yeah. Or the Toll House chocolate chip cookie. I mean, it's perfect.
Yeah, my family was the custard because grew up on the farm. We had eggs, we had milk. Just add sugar, mix the whole thing together, and then put whatever you want on the bottom of that dish and put it on a double boiler in the oven and bake it.
Kathy's rice pudding is one of those things, too, where you've got extra rice around, and so you're just kind of making a dessert out of the things that you have.
Yeah, and in my house, for the custard, often it would be the old bread. You know, if we had bread, it'd be like the idea of the pain perdu idea, but just on the bottom of the dish, not like the whole dish filled up. The rest was all custard. So it was easy to eat as a kid, you know, especially as dessert. You just have custard for dessert. You know,
it'd be interesting to go through. You know, I'm fascinated with recipe boxes. I have a collection right outside the hot stove here. And when I buy them online, I get them on eBay or someplace like that. And I buy ones that are unique that I don't own already. But I'd love to buy them with the recipe still in the box.
That's a jackpot.
Sometimes at garage sales and stuff, they're literally right there with 100 years of recipes in there. But so many. Literally so many will actually make a notation. Got this from the back of a Jell-O box, and then write down the recipe, right? Or it's interesting how, and now they show up at Thanksgiving, right? Your most traditional meal of the year, somehow these recipes off the back of containers have made it
and
to your table.
I think they're very yum.
It's very interesting. What else? Can't just have one kind of pie.
Oh, God, no. Growing up, we had like 6 to 8 pies. One thing we always had was something called cranberry Jell-O salad. Now, stay with me here.
Hang on.
So it was like raspberry Jell-O, a can of cranberries, and sour cream. I would never go there now. But the flavors of the creamy, tart, sour cream with cranberries and the sweetness, I just absolutely adore that flavor combination. So one of the things I love is like a ricotta or a cream cheese tart. So it's shallow, so it's not baking all day, but it's that cream cheese flavor, tangy, and then topped with a beautiful homemade cranberry compote.
Interesting.
Just delicious.
I could get with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Cranberries are one of those things in my house that, I mean, I have literally made my own cranberry sauce forever, and my daughter one time had the can of cranberry, like Ocean Spray cranberry, at her grandma's house. And she won't give it up. She was like,
"This is my family to a T."
Yep. Every Thanksgiving, she brings that awful stuff. She loves it, but I think it's just weird to the table with the can rings still around it.
Absolutely. That's part of its charm.
And there I've got this beautiful homemade cranberry sauce, and I watch the jellied stuff go around the table, literally gone. And then I go when I'm cleaning up dinner. It's like, there's my entire bowl of fresh cranberry chutney that nobody gives a darn about.
The ring canberry sauce, it makes like a nice slice for your turkey sandwich
the next
day.
Oh, yeah, you really get to see how evenly to cut the cranberry
is,
too, because the rings are there.
I mean, the good thing about your chutney, Tom, is you can keep eating it with that
culture. Oh, yeah, great.
I
throw it away. I'm so disgusted. I just throw it in the garbage. And you people don't deserve my
cranberry
chutney.
We unmold it onto like a beautiful spode china plate.
I'm My favorite part is you turn it and you go, made in USA.
Yeah, exactly.
Up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. This is our last segment. Please hang with us. It's going to be so fun because I'm going to win it all today.
All right. I'm excited when you talk like
coming
that.
In with confidence.
Brittany, that means we have a chance.
Yeah,
last week
we
I had
do.
A SmackDown with Brittany.
Yep.
A Slapdown, not a SmackDown,
slap
a Slapdown.
Mm-hmm.
And crushed her. Like it's crushed weird. Her like a can of crushed pineapple.
Like a can of cranberry.
I was going to say, yeah, cranberry jelly. That's what I thought you were
going to
say.
Anyway, KDO, you're going to administer today.
That's right. This is our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, where each of you are going to receive 5 food-related trivia questions. And if you lose today, you have to give something to one of our listeners. And today you are playing for Susan LaPlante Ronning. She graciously went to our Seattle Kitchen Facebook page and gave us her recipe, her grandma's recipe, actually. Grandma's Anything's Goes Strata recipe.
Ooh.
After we had discussed bread puddings.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Even the savory ones, which are extra, extra delicious. So, Thierry, if you lose today, what will you give to Susan?
I think I'm going to give her 2 scrambled eggs and caviar at Lule with a glass of champagne.
Ooh.
She's into eggs. I'm going to give her some eggs.
I would not invite anyone with me. I just eat by myself.
I'd take a dozen.
2 glasses of champagne and 2 caviar eggs
I think
for
that's
me,
a great,
please.
You know, she's into eggs. Yeah. I'm
how do you feel about that, Sarah and Tina and Brittany, that Katie wouldn't even invite you with her?
Don't act like you might not consider the same route. Brittany, what will you give away?
I'll do a $50 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery. We got your Thanksgiving pie covered there.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Tom?
I'm going to give away an opportunity to box pies at the Dahlia Bakery.
Ooh, fun.
The day before Thanksgiving at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Is that how we're getting people to do it now?
Free, yeah. It's free.
It's
I'm
free.
Giving
all
it away.
All of a sudden, no one's participating on the Seattle Kitchen Facebook page.
No, I am going to give away the leftover cranberry sauce from my Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. Just package that up. And then the court
that's going to be a lot of cranberry sauce.
And then dinner for 2 at Tanaka-san, our kind of L.A. punk fusion Asian bento dumpling bar.
Delish. All right. Thierry Rotaro, you're first up on this quiz. Your first question, what southern side dish was originally prepared to placate begging dogs?
I must say to the audience who can't see this, Sarah is right next to me, our assistant producer. And she's cracking up because she's just like looking
at
hush.
Me.
Okay, hush puppies. How's
that? Oh,
yeah. Okay. Was that a good one? I owe you one, Tom.
You owe Tom taking some of that cranberry sauce home with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll make you some.
Second question. What cake has the simple recipe of 1 pound of sugar, 1 pound of eggs, 1 pound of flour, and 1 pound of butter?
Would that be the pound cake, by any chance?
That would be the pound cake. Your third question. What pizza top eaten isn't really bacon at all, but fully cooked and smoked pork? It's not really bacon.
I'm going to go with pepperoni.
That is incorrect. We were looking for Canadian bacon, not actually bacon.
I kind of feeling, but who the hell put that on the pizza?
I do.
Oh, are you a Hawaiian fan?
Oh, yeah. Bring it on.
No judgment here. No judgment. Your fourth question, Thierry. True or false, domesticated turkeys can't fly?
I'm going to go with true on that.
It's actually false. Most can't, but that's because of their weight. All right. And your final question, true or false, oysters are kosher?
Oh, that's a trick question. Shellfish. Let me see. No.
What, true or false?
False.
That's correct. False. That means, Thierry, you get 3 out of 5. Not a bad showing. Brittany, you are next.
Woo-hoo.
Your first question, what burrito-dwelling spice is also known as coriander or Chinese parsley?
Cilantro.
That is correct. Your second question, this Indian spice will turn your rice yellow. It was once known as Indian saffron, and its name begins with the letter T.
Turmeric.
Looks a lot like your sweater today.
It does.
Yeah.
Very turmeric color.
There you go.
Actually, that's green mustard.
yellow
mustard.
Third question, Eggs Benedict Florentine replaces ham with what vegetable?
Spinach.
Yes, I love that
Me
version.
Too.
And your fourth question, outside of America, bacon is usually made from 1 of 2 cuts of pork. Name one of them, please.
The belly?
No.
Well, isn't it the pork loin? Yeah, it's not the belly.
Yeah.
It's not the belly or the fat back.
The bacon in America is made from the belly.
Oh, right. Outside of America.
Yeah.
Oops. Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
It's okay. I was almost going to give it to you, but.
You are almost. You were definitely giving
it
to
me. Really
if
were.
I hadn't stepped in, I'd be.
I just heard bacon.
I know. Actually, you know what? Honestly, I read bacon and then everything
that's it.
Went
everything
dark.
Goes out the door.
Yeah. Okay. Your fifth question. As a Euro weren't hard enough to say, what's the name of the cucumber yogurt sauce they put on those things?
Raita? Or is that. That's wrong.
That is incorrect.
Oh, tzatziki. No.
That is correct.
Yep. Tzatziki. Do we give it to her even though she said Raita?
I'll let you decide.
We gave Terry one, so we'll give Brittany
one. I like Tina.
Totally.
Tina was asked on my side. Whole show.
And you know what Tina would have said?
That woke her up.
You know what Tina would have said if I had done that?
No. Brittany, a great showing today. 4 out of 5, Tom. You're pulling up the rear. Here we go. Nothing unusual about that. First question. Like fireworks and other awesome things, bacon smoking apparently began in what country?
I'm either going to say China or Germany, so I'm going to go with China.
That is correct. On Gilligan's Island, what kind of pie was Mary Ann's specialty and beloved by Gilligan?
What kind of pie? And it was Marianne.
Marianne.
So that's the brunette.
Yeah.
Because Ginger was the redhead, right?
She was the actress.
So Marianne looked a little Pennsylvania Dutch. So I'm going to say shoe fly pie.
Mm. They were on an island, Tom, so they were actually...
pineapple pie.
I'm going to say pineapple.
How about coconut cream pie?
Oh, my God. Never let you live that one down.
That's even funnier.
Wow, everybody. Okay, your third question. True or false, salmonella is named for the fish?
False.
It's for an Italian guy from Boston named Salmonella.
All right, your fourth question. The stocks make a tart pie beloved by Garrison Keillor, but what fruit's leaves will kill you if you eat a whole bunch of them?
My least favorite pie. Why did I get all the pie questions today?
Well, because we thought you were going to get one of them.
Oh, I did. Rhubarb.
Yeah, that is right. Rhubarb is correct. And your final question, Tom. Don't say cherry, a Roma tomato, also known by what other fruity name?
Could you repeat the question,
please?
Yeah.
Don't say cherry, a Roma tomato is also known by what other fruity name?
Plum.
That is correct. That means you also get a 4 out of 5 tying, Brittany, for the top score, which means Thierry Rocher, I'm sorry.
Hey, I'm not sorry. She's going to be very excited.
Yes, Susan, eat all the caviar and all the eggs and drink all the champagne.
Absolutely.
Way to go, Susan. If you want to be a smart person and part of the show like Susan, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, and our show is produced by Tina Knowles, although she didn't do much today.
Nope.
And our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz. Our sound engineer is Sean, don't call me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.